Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The power of thought.
I bet you women would like to know what men are really thinking. The truth, the honest truth of what men are really thinking. Because I could tell you. Would you like to know? All right, I'll tell you. Nothing.
Human thought has given us science, literature, and morality.
Human thought has given us superstition, slavery, and war.
That's why we're honking car horns, yelling from construction sites. These are the best ideas we've had so far.
How does the magic of language enable us to share our thoughts with others?
Newman?
Yes?
What are you doing?
I'm thinking.
Well, think me up a cup of coffee and a chocolate donut with some of those little sprinkles on top, will you, as long as you're thinking?
How many different thoughts can you think?
Dr. Bob, the patient is sinking.
I wonder what he is sinking about.
Our guest is renowned cognitive scientist Steven Pinker.
The power of thought.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Everything except your intelligence, that is. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the power of thought.
Ken, human thought's an amazing thing. It's given us science, literature, morality, and last, but certainly not least, philosophy.
And thought even has the power, John, to create sort of ex nihilo, brand new realities on its own.
You're thinking of the realities that created by novels and artists of various sorts?
No, I'm thinking of the whole social world, everything from clubs to nations and every kind of social reality in between. They're all sort of creations out of nothing of the human mind.
Yeah, but the human mind is unfortunately not all sweetness and light. It's given us superstition, slavery, and the basis of war.
Yeah, and that makes the nature and power of human thought really all the more puzzling, John, because the mind that spent millennium after millennium mired in archaic social formations, in the grips of irrational superstitions, is the very same mind with the very same powers of thought as the mind that has produced science, philosophy, and art.
Well, our modest goal today is just to understand what enables human thought to do all these different things.
So where do we start with that modest goal?
Well, let's start at the beginning. What are thoughts?
Well, that's easy. Thoughts are things inside our heads, inside the brain if you're a materialist, you'll think, inside the mind if you're a dualist.
Well, you've told us where thoughts are, but not what they are. If we're going to understand the power of thought, we at least ought to distinguish some of the different kinds of thoughts and think about how they work.
I get your point. I get your point. Take a simple thing like the belief that there's beer in the fridge. Now, there's a thought for you, but it's only one kind of thought.
Sure. I mean, you might also want a beer. That's a thought, too, but it's a different kind of thought. It's a desire.
Yeah, now, beliefs represent or sometimes misrepresent how things are in the world. They're the kinds of things that can be true or false.
Hopefully, our beliefs are more true than false. If our beliefs are false, then what we should do is change our beliefs to match the world.
Desires, on the other hand, don't represent how the world is. We don't say, for example, that my desire to have a beer is false just because I don't have a beer.
But we do have a word for it. We do say your desire is unsatisfied when you want a beer, but you don't have one.
And now the way to satisfy a desire is not to change it. Right? As we said with a belief, if it's false, change it. With a desire, if it's unsatisfied, don't change it. Change the world.
And that's where the third kind of thought comes in, intentions. If you believe there's a beer in the fridge and you really want a beer, then maybe you'll form a new kind of thought, an intention to get one.
And an intention is the kind of thing that can actually make you get off your duff, walk over to the fridge and get a beer, and presto changer, you've changed the world. You've now got that beer.
Yeah, although intentions don't always do their job if you're a weak-willed, lazy, sort of procrastinating guy like me.
Right. Well, yeah, that's true, John. Now, but look, if you really want to understand the power of thought, we have to understand how beliefs manage to represent or sometimes misrepresent the way the world is.
And how desires manage to set forth the ways the world might become.
And how intentions actually move us to actually act to change the world. You know, that sounds like a pretty tall order for 1 hour.
Well, we've got one advantage because all these things, beliefs, desires, and intentions, seem to be built out of the same basic building blocks, just kind of put together in different ways.
Right. They're all built out of concepts or ideas. My belief that there's a beer in the fridge, my desire to drink a beer, and my intentions to go get a beer, they all involve the concept or idea of beer. For example.
So let's start by thinking about the nature of concepts or ideas. Where do they come from? How can they be put together to create such a wide variety of thoughts?
And then once we have a handle on that issue, we can think more about the different things the different kinds of thoughts do.
Well, it sounds like a plan, but you and I are certainly not up to carrying it out.
Well, we've got help on the way. We're going to be joined soon by Steven Pinker, the world-renowned author of an amazing series of books about the human mind, including his most recent, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window on Human Nature.
And we'll have another advantage. We have the help of our very thoughtful listening audience.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, took to the streets to find out what some non-philosophers think about the nature of thought. She files this report.
What are thoughts, and where do they come from?
Gosh, that's a tough one.
To find out, I asked people in downtown San Francisco.
Basically, I guess it's what we process, what we see, smell, you know, our senses. So whatever we sense is just how we process it, and I think that's where thoughts come from.
I don't have an answer. I have to think.
So, you have to think about what thought is?
Yeah.
I would summarize thought as conscious and subconscious imagery and words that flow into your head that you don't always voice or act upon.
I think images end up provoking thoughts, that you see something and then that triggers the idea that is what we call a thought.
Well, I guess it's a rationalization kind of between your spirit and your brain. Is your mind different from your brain? Well, I consider your brain to be the actual physical, but your mind is the not physical, I guess.
My thoughts are random. I actually like play something in my head, think about it, analyze it, and then I, you know, that's how my thought comes out.
Something that you imagine in your brain, some of that like just pops up, I guess. It kind of comes out of nowhere because, you know, it's just like right now popped in my head that I need to go home and sleep because I'm tired, kind of.
Well, recently I felt like it's like an accumulation of everybody's thoughts put together.
Thoughts, I believe, in my mind, would be created by words that we learn from infancy on up. It's like a building block, and so we build on that, and then we put combinations together. Our own creative mind works somehow to build upon those blocks that we've learned.
I think actually in some weird way it kind of goes out in the universe and bounces off everyone else in the world and people, places, things.
I think the mind operates so that it remembers things, and when you think a thought it's something from the past coming through your head. I don't know where it goes after that. Really, I don't.
I guess just the desire to know more about whatever topic is being discussed. Thoughts are, in my opinion, just trying to figure out more about a topic than you already know.
I guess I haven't really thought about my own thoughts at that level. So a thought comes from maybe an inner desire or memory or reminder or maybe a habit. And where does it go? I guess it goes back into that stash of memories and habits, and I don't know. I really haven't thought about thoughts.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Steven Pinker. He has thought a lot about thoughts. He's a world-renowned linguist and cognitive scientist from Harvard University. He's author of many, many things about the mind, including his most recent, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Steven, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Steven, you're clearly fascinated by the human mind in general and human language in particular. What first made you want to spend your life thinking about language and the mind?
And did you know that it would make you rich, Steven?
that I didn't know. And I think like many people, I kind of fell into my calling rather than being called by it. I certainly was always interested in human nature, partly growing up in the 60s and 70s when human nature was the basis for all kinds of political debates. Are people naturally selfish? Are they naturally cooperative? Are they naturally violent? Are they naturally peaceable? When I started taking courses in college, I found that psychology had the nice intersection between these ancient problems of human nature and tractable ways of studying it, namely laboratory experiments. I knew that cognitive psychology was the area that I found most interesting, and when I got to graduate school, it was language that seemed to have the biggest opportunities to say something that hadn't been said before. And so more and more of my research got sucked into language, not because I started off as a linguist or interested in language, but just that it was one aspect of the human mind where I thought I could make a contribution.
So, Stephen, when you think about language, a simple-minded but I think basically correct view is that you got three things. You got the words, You got ideas, and you got the things in the world that the ideas and the words stand for. But which one is really dominant? I mean, take something simple like snow. In English, we talk about snow. We can talk about it's being snowy. We can talk about it snowing. We got a verb. We've got adjectives and so forth. I'm told, maybe out of date, that in northern climes, they have many more words for snow, but they're just one kind of thing, snow. So why do we have so many words? Because we have a lot of ideas, or because there's really a lot of subtle differences between kinds of snow we don't know about?
Well, that factoid is sometimes known as the great Eskimo vocabulary hoax, because the Eskimos don't have 50 or 100 or 200 words for snow, as is sometimes claimed.
Oh, but too granted, bad.
They have a dozen. Well, there are different kinds of snow, and there are different aspects of snow. It falls, and then it stays on the ground, and it coagulates and so on. And the human mind is sensitive to these distinctions. We reason about stuff in the world and about its different attributes and what you can do with it. And so we have different words to pinpoint different aspects of reality that are useful to our purposes.
So what about words like this? Well, the word I just uttered, this. I mean, John and I have both spent our lives thinking about words like this, that, I, you,
oh,
here,
yeah.
There. Why don't we just have like names like Bill, John? Why do we have I, this, you?
Yeah. It's partly because conversation takes place between two humans, each of which has a point of view. We're interested in each other's points of view, and there's some words that describe what the world is like from a point of view. We also have to distinguish, as we have a long conversation, between things that we're introducing for the first time and things that the other guy already knows about, and we're referring back to it. And so we have pronouns like this and that and him and her, so that we make it clear that if I start talking about John, you know that it's you have reason to believe that it's a new guy named John that I'm talking about for the first time, whereas if I say him, I'm referring to a person that has already been in our little theater.
I want to get at the difference between the way philosophers used to think about language, not so much anymore, and the way linguists and psycholinguists and social linguists think about language. One of my teachers back in graduate school used to say that Frege and Russell, these are the great philosophical students of language from the 21st century, were interested in what language would be like if it had been invented by a logician, right? So they thought that logic was this instrument of thought and pristine logical, language was this imperfect instrument of thought, and it didn't reflect the perfection of logic, and you had to get out all this messy stuff, so that Quine even said in a pristine scientific language, we wouldn't have words like this and that, I, you, these perspectival words. It just because it would be third personal. Do you think, were philosophers just crazy to think about language that way?
Well, they did ignore a big part of the design spec of language. Not only does it have to represent thoughts, but it's got to be usable. It's got to be learnable by a child. It's got to be producible by these fleshy things that we have in our mouths. It's got to be comprehensible by a human ear. The thoughts have to be assembled in real time by a brain with limited short-term memory. The particular thoughts that we express in language have to be embedded in the context of our intentions and our social relationship with the other person. So if you throw all of those design specs into the picture, you're going to end up with something that isn't exactly like logic, although there is a kernel of language that makes some logical distinctions, but it's going to be encrusted with all of this other stuff that is our compromises respecting all of the usability constraints.
Now, one philosopher that started out as a student of Russell's, Wittgenstein, really incorporated two quite different views of language into a single career. He started off with this kind of logician's picture of language that Ken talks about, mostly asking the question, what does a language need to describe reality? But then in his later work, he has more the picture of language as something that starts off integrated into human activity, what he calls language games. So that raises the question, what's more important, description and action, or maybe which came first, description and action? Maybe they're equally important.
Probably action came first, simply because if anything evolved, it evolved because of its consequences. That's really at the core of Darwin's theory of natural selection. Organisms that have a trait that bring them some kind of goodies in terms of survival or reproduction will propagate, and those are the traits that will come down to us today. So it's likely that the ability of language to get some rise out of people, to have some effect, came first. On the other hand, the kind of effects that we humans try to achieve with our language pertains to stuff about the world that we know about and that we want to share. And so if all we could do with words was to say, you know, let's go, watch out, hey, get out of my face, then language would not be nearly as useful as it is, and our species would not nearly be as successful as it is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing the power of thought with renowned cognitive scientist Steven Pinker.
In our next segment, we're going to talk about the things we do with language. Language can be used to express our beliefs and describe the world, but also to issue commands, to praise and blame, even to usher into existence new social realities. How does language manage to do all these things? And what does it show about the nature of thought itself?
The many varieties of thought and language when Philosophy Talk continues.
Think about the good things, the bad things, all the things to think about. Where do all these thoughts come from? That's what we're asking today. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the power of thought with noted cognitive scientist Steven Pinker. So, Steven, earlier on, John and I were saying that there are different kinds of thoughts, their beliefs, desires, and intentions, to name just some of them. And, you know, we can use language to express any of these different kinds of thoughts. When I make an assertion, for example, I express my belief. When I, at least if I'm being sincere, when I make a promise, I express my intentions. When I make a request, I express my desires. Let me ask you, what explains? Is there some deep explanation of this parallelism between language and thought?
Yeah, the reason that we have language is to express our thoughts and our intentions and our desires. So there's nothing coincidental about it. If we had nothing to say, there'd be no reason that we'd be making these noises out of our mouths. Now, granted, there are some species who do make noises. Birdsong, for example, is a complex syntactic combination of sounds. But they don't refer to particular thoughts, other than the general thought of announcing territory or advertising your mate value. What's unusual about humans as a species is that our vocal communication system corresponds to our thoughts in a grammatical way. That is, our thoughts are built out of parts, their concepts and their relations between them, and our language is built out of parts. We have nouns and verbs that we combine into phrases and sentences, and the order in which we combine words in our speech tells other people something about what we're thinking, what we want, and what we're about to do.
But now in philosophy, there's been a lot of emphasis, or in the last century, there was a lot of emphasis, it continues, on kind of the basic logical form of thought. And Russell thought you could express it in the predicate calculus, which is kind of a very simple language. You just have subjects and, he wouldn't want to say predicates, but open sentences. You don't have adverbs and adjectives and nouns and verbs. You just have predicates and words for things, and then a few quantifiers. Is the complexity of our language, the adverbs, the adjectives, the various kinds of nouns, is that reflect the way the world is or the way our mind likes to deal with things?
I would say aspects of the world that our mind is very good at reasoning about. The world is made up of all kinds of objects, and they're made up of different kinds of stuff, and they do various things in various ways, various speeds. What our mind evolved to do is to cotton on to all of the different aspects of reality, represent them separately, and then recombine them so we can think
about. But Stephen, let me ask you a question about that. So there we have lots of words of all different kinds. And we were talking about, you know, there are words for things, words for properties of things, words for events. But often we have, just take an example, we have many words for the same things. So there's a polite way to call somebody, say, an African-American, and there's a derogatory way to call, I won't mention the word, to call somebody an African-American. That's not the world, is it? Why do we have multiple words for the same thing? I mean, if the languages just reflect the world, then it should have the sort of same cardinality, as it were.
Yep.
But there seem to be more words than there are things.
Absolutely, and I have, in fact, a whole chapter in the Stuff of Thought on swearing, on taboo language. And
right.
The N-word that you alluded to is a kind of profanity. We tend to think of swearing as having to do with excretion and sexuality and divinity, but it all in many languages, and including modern American English, the absolute worst, most incendiary swear word is the word for a certain racial minority. It's because words also convey the speaker's attitude. The reason that we have both obscene words for the act of excretion and the products and for sexuality, and polite ones, is that sometimes we want to call attention to how truly awful or emotionally arousing some concept is. Sometimes we'd rather keep it out of our consciousness. So, for example, in a doctor's office, when the nurse asks you for a stool sample, she has a perfectly legitimate reason for doing it, and she uses the word stool, not the other four-letter word, because the point of that communication is not to rub your nose in how awful it is, but it's just a fact of life that every once in a while we really do have to confer with what to do with these emotionally upsetting thoughts and actions.
Now, I want to press you on this just a little bit, because I agree with everything you said. Now, I think, if I recall correctly, Chomsky... And I think you started out as a Chomskyan. Chomsky thinks that it's kind of, in some sense, accidental that we use language to communicate, and that it's not part of the essence of language that it's a tool for communication. Something else is part of the essence of language, which I could never quite figure out when I delved into Chomsky. It sounds like you think of language as partly designed to enable us to express our attitudes and that kind of thing, and to describe the world and to communicate. Is that right or wrong? Is language designed for these things, or is it just a kind of accidental feature of language that we can do these things with it?
Well, I've argued that language is designed for it, and that's certainly one of the main points of disagreement between Chomsky and myself. I believe that language is a biological adaptation, like color vision or motor control. It's got an obvious adaptive function in an intelligent social species, namely allowing us to share knowledge and to coordinate our behavior. So, yes, indeed, I think language is designed, and I think it's designed to communicate. And it's true that Chomsky is very skeptical of that idea.
How could one be skeptical of that idea? I just want to pause over that, since it seems to me and many philosophers so obvious. But it has always puzzled me how Chomskyans are puzzled over that idea. How could that not be right?
Well, I mean, one can speculate about it. I mean, I suspect that it's part of Chomsky's general rationalist philosophy, by which things aren't there for a useful purpose. That we have a perhaps an innate desire to express thought, but the fact that it actually brings us anything, which of course is what any Darwinian explanation appeals to. Well, the reason we have our traits is that they increased the reproductive success of our ancestors. That is, they had consequences that allowed us to survive or reproduce. It's very foreign, I think, to the way that Chomsky thinks about aspects of mental life.
Stephen, I want to ask you, we've talked a little bit about Chomsky. Now, I want to ask you about a big issue in philosophy, that two pictures of which kinds of words and phrases are basic. Kind of the common sense picture is some kind, it's called the Phido theory. It's the idea that, look, what's basic about language is names. We have names for things and kinds of things. And sentences are derivative. They just come from putting words together. But in the 20th century, a lot of philosophers said, no, sentences are basic because sentences are the things that fit into thoughts. A belief has to be a belief that so-and-so is such-and-such. A desire has to be a desire that so-and-so have such-and-such. So sentences are basic. Now, from your kind of more empirical, very philosophically sophisticated, but more empirical point of view, which is more important, sentences or words?
Well, they're both important. I suppose words are in some sense more basic, and that one could make an argument that cognitively simpler animals have the equivalent of words, and in fact you can teach chimpanzees and parrots labels for concepts, for basic objects or actions. It's much, much harder to teach them to combine them into sentences, perhaps even impossible, but certainly much, much harder, whereas that comes naturally to us. So I think it's easier to imagine words without sentences than sentences without words.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Steven Pinker about the power of thought. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Lisa in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisa.
Hello, how are you?
Okay.
I'm very glad you were able to take my call. Thank you.
So what's your comment or question, Lisa?
Well, when I was listening to people talk about the origins of language, I understood from Umberto Maturana, who was a biologist, that language actually originated in the early human societies where cooperation was essential to survival. And consensuses needed to be arrived at in order to define the reality around them, in order to name things, in order to be able to cooperate. And so I believe that language originated out of, just like someone said, they're out of action, but out of cooperative action.
Well, Lisa, thanks for the comment. That's an important comment. But, Stephen, I want to press that question. Rephrase that question just a little bit. I think it's true. Language is a cooperative thing. And probably its origins is in, you know, coordinating our need to solve certain coordination problems. But here's something else. Thought seems to be a private thing, a thing essentially inside my own head and inside your head. So tell me, help me understand this gap between the essential publicity of language and the essential privacy of thought.
Language is what makes private thoughts more public. And I think Lisa put her finger on an important feature of language, namely, it is a cooperative venture. We have the expression to be on speaking terms. We also have the expression to have something to say, referring to those thoughts that we externalize using language. If you look at our species, Homo sapiens, we're a deeply weird species. We have three things that make us very different from just about every species, especially in combination. One is that we're highly social, even among other organisms that aren't our blood relatives. We cooperate not just with our parents and our brothers and our sisters and our first cousins, but also with people who aren't related to us at all, and that tends not to happen in the animal kingdom. Secondly, we're technological. We make our living by things that we invent, thanks to knowledge that we acquire in our own lifetimes. We don't simply have a set of instinctive ways of hunting and protecting ourselves from the elements, but we build houses and tents and yurts and tools and poisons and bows and arrows, none of which are part of our innate repertoire, but some of us invent and others learn it from those who invented them or from those who learn from those who learn from those who learned. And the third thing, of course, is we have language. We have grammatical language. We don't just have emotional calls. We don't just tweet and Twitter in the literal sense of do it. And I think it's not a coincidence that those three zoologically unusual traits are all found in the same species. Because if we weren't on, as we say, speaking terms, if we weren't cooperating, why would we share our hard-won knowledge? All we would be doing is helping our competitors. But if you're in a relationship in which people are members of the same species are exchanging favors, are benefiting from the gains in trade, then know-how is the ultimate commodity that's useful in trading, because it can be exchanged at a very small cost but convey a huge benefit to the listener.
So, Stephen, this all sounds true and profound and really cool. But I want to ask you about this cooperative thing. I want to ask you about this. Which came first, though? So we have these very complex, highly structured minds. Our minds are really, we got this, you know, I can think all kinds of thoughts, very articulate. I can think the thoughts of quantum physics and calculus and set theory and thoughts about politics, and I can talk about all those things. Do I have the language that is as complex as I have it because thought is so complicated, or is it that thought is so complicated, you know, is shaped by language? I mean, which came first?
I think thought came first. For one thing, we know that the species that are closely related to us and presumably represent a rough picture of the species from which we evolved, namely chimps and other great apes, certainly have complex thoughts, but they have rudimentary to no language. Also, it's not clear how you could evolve language if you didn't have anything to say in the first place, anything that was worth sharing. Certainly, language can affect thought because that's why we have language, so we could partake of the thoughts of others and combine them with our own thoughts. So certainly a lot of the content of our thought came through the conduit of language from other people, from our culture. But thought is far more
fun. But doesn't language somehow enable thought in new ways? So look, somebody invents the concept of a quark. Right, in the fertile imaginations of their own scientific mind. All I do is read about it in a book. And presto chango, I can now think thoughts about quantum mechanics that I could not have thought before. And how is that made possible? Through language. So doesn't language somehow enable new possibilities for thought?
Yes, in fact, I mean, that's why we have language, exactly. But for the guy who thought up the quark, I suppose it was Murray Gell-Mann, at least he named it, obviously no one told him what a quark was through language. He cooked it up, And in fact, many mathematicians and physicists and creative people often say that they have to struggle to find the words to express some concept that they have with some combination of imagery, purely conceptual or mathematical thought, and then they'll coin a term, as Gell-Mann did with quark, to put it into words. We mere mortals can then acquire it just by reading the person's words. But what we have acquired is not just a sound, but we've arranged a set of internal concepts that correspond, you know, kind of, more or less, to some approximation to the thoughts in the mind of the original coiner. Likewise, by the way, when we acquire language, it's very hard to imagine how we could acquire language unless we had some capacity to think beforehand. And a lot of experiments on preverbal infants show that they have their minds are populated by a rich set of concepts for agents, for objects, for causality, and that the first words and the first grammatical constructions come from mapping the sounds that the child hears from parents and playmates onto thoughts that they were having in the first place.
Okay, we're talking to Steven Pinker about the power of thought. Paul in Berkeley's on the line. I'll take your question before the break. We may answer it after the break, Paul. What's your comment or question?
Okay, my comment was that the contents, what goes on in the mind is in a way ineffable, and then language becomes a rough approximation to try to communicate it. And some things are communicated better than others. If you think of like trying to communicate the sense of a dream, for instance. And so then the language is an effort to share what is going on inside our head, our thoughts. And I think in the end, too, then the language, because we're so used to putting things in terms of language, it becomes an internal method to, like, organizing our thoughts and sorting them out.
You're breaking up, Paul.
Stephen, he asked a question about whether there's stuff in the mind that can't be put into language. Can you answer that for me briefly, or we can take that up after the break?
Oh, absolutely. I think anything that's analog, that's continuous, is very difficult to convey in words because language is fundamentally digital, especially if it's analog and multidimensional. For example, how you tie a necktie or how you do a dance step, it'd be very hard to describe that over the phone, precisely because language is good at externalizing some kinds of thoughts, our combinatorial propositions, but is very bad at externalizing others.
Some philosophers think that the mind can't be just a material thing because there is stuff about our conscious experience, for example, that could not possibly put in anything like language. But let's return to that question after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the power of thought with Steven Pinker, author of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature.
Over the centuries, both thought and language have changed in remarkable ways. New words and concepts are created all the time. Sometimes philosophers help with this. And old ones are discarded. What drives such change? Do the powers of the mind remain fundamentally the same through such changes, or has the mind itself transformed as language and thought have transformed?
How changing thought changes language, and how change in language changes thought, when Philosophy Talk continues.
My heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry. Life would be a ding-a-derry if I only had a brain.
The power to think and speak without a brain, only in the movies. At least I think only in the movies. I've never seen my own brain, but I think people would have noticed if I didn't have one. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Everything except your intelligence, that is. And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the power of thought with noted cognitive scientist Steven Pinker.
Steven, I made a point that there's a difference between the descriptive function of language that logic and philosophy have often focused on, and a more, what seems to me a more reasonable view about where language came from, which is a way of influencing action, and you yourself have mentioned that in the last segment. So I want to ask kind of a two-tiered question. First of all, isn't it more reasonable to think of language as starting out as having mostly an action-influencing function and only derivatively a descriptive function? And secondly, how has language changed, not just since we originally evolved, but over recorded history? Has it changed a lot, and what drives the change?
Take the first question first, and then we'll get to the second one.
I think it's pretty plausible that language originated as a way of affecting other people's action, because anything that evolved because of its effects. And so just the ability to deliver soliloquies or to muse out loud, that wouldn't seem to confer any adaptive benefit. On the other hand, if you could exchange favors with one of your village mates, I'll do this for you now if you do something else for me later, or I'll beat the bushes to.
But aren't you guys making a false dichotomy? Isn't the ability to describe the world really, really important? Because what you were saying earlier, Stephen, because if I, through language, I can share my evidence and beliefs about the world with you, so that if I invent the quark and I characterize it, you don't have to go through all the experiments. You can get the benefits of all my cognition just by reading my words.
That's an important function of language now.
Wasn't it always? There's a tiger over there. I mean, there is an action-influencing thing, but it's also an evidence-giving thing. And aren't these things co-equal?
I don't think so, but let's hear what Stephen has to say.
Well, the reason that we can't just say, let's go, let's do it, watch out, is because we do react to the world in ways that are specific to what's in the world. We don't just share our emotional states. But we talk about things, and we tell people what we want them to do and what we plan to do. On the other hand, if you're rewinding the tape and going back to some intermediate stage between the primates and ourselves, we know that other animals have communication systems that are just calls to action, like watch out, look up, look down, let's go, get out of my way. So it's kind of plausible that part of language, at least in time, preceded the kind of language where you can actually refer to stuff out there.
So it sounds to me like the ability to describe and represent the world in language is a great advance over mere animal calls to action, John. So take that. But we've got a lineup of callers trying to get in here. And Kim from Fairfax is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kim.
Thanks a lot. I was researching a book that I wrote called Saved by a Poem, and I came upon a book called The Singing Neanderthals by Stephen Mithin, which is his proposal is that the origin of language is something that he calls a musolanguage, or HMMMM. And he says that language actually emerged out of the need to speak the things of the heart that couldn't be put into pragmatic communications, which were delivered through action, through sign language. And so it's a very kind of opposite way of thinking about language than what usually I hear, which is that language is to communicate, hey, look out, there's a wildebeest behind you.
Right.
Rather, it's language is here to say, when I look into your eyes, my heart swells like the moon, something that actually can't be said by going, hoo, hoo, ha, ha.
Yeah, language as an instrument of seduction. Thank you, Kev. Stephen Mithin is a very prolific researcher, but what do you think about this thought, Stephen Pinker?
I mean, we don't really know what the earliest stages of language were, and language can do a lot of things. Certainly, there's reason to believe that at least the ability of language to convey complex thoughts with grammar, with subjects and verbs and predicates, may even be separate from just the ability to bill and coo and to share emotion. We have reason to believe this because people who have damage to the left hemisphere of the brain from a stroke or a head injury often have the ability to sing, to swear, to use tone of voice in an expressive way, to express affection through tone of voice, all of which seem to be done in the primarily in the right hemisphere. So there may not be an either-or as to what language can do, because we have these different kinds of language.
So let me take you back to the second question that John asked in his barrage of questions opening this segment. First, I want to ask you a factual question. To what extent do people now think and speak the way people always have? I mean, the earliest people could not do higher mathematics or quantum mechanics, or didn't have democratic polity and the terms and justification for democratic polity, right? So our conceptual landscape is radically different. But are our minds radically different? I mean, what persists through change, and how much change is there really?
It depends on what you mean by mind. I mean, I think the basic ability to entertain a thought, the basic constituents of thought, are unchanged. But obviously, the contents of thought, the ability to think of a Newtonian universe or an Einsteinian universe or to entertain complex theological concepts requires an awful lot of intermediate steps. Now, obviously, our minds, the mind of anyone is capable of being led along that path because that's what we did as children. We had to recapitulate all of the building of this edifice of abstract thought that our civilization has put together between the time that we're kids and the time that we're adults. So it depends on what you mean by mind. I think the basic abilities are present in any normal member of Homo sapiens.
So the basic abilities. What? So I know there are people who believe, my friend and former colleague, still friend and former colleague, Jerry Fodor, has a wild, what I regard as a wild view. He thinks that, subject to a little bit of correction, all concepts are innate. And he thinks they couldn't be other than innate. So what do you think about that kind of view? Because you could think, well, where do all these concepts come from? Because one of the cool things about the human mind is its plasticity. But you think, is it indefinitely plasticistic? Is there no limits to our conceptual horizons? If we imagine a future, does anything go? And some people think, well, there are limits because there are these innate concepts and innate stock, and all we can possibly think is what can be gotten out of the combination and recombination of these innate concepts. What do you think about that kind of view?
Yeah, well, in the Stuff of Thought, I have a chapter in honor of Jerry Fodor called 50,000 Innate Concepts and Other Matters.
I'm trying to set you up, Stephen.
No, I don't think that's right. I don't think that all our concepts are innate. I mean, I'll go along with Fodor in agreeing that our fundamental concepts, that the building blocks of thought are innate. That's almost true by definition. But Jerry Fodor also believes that the concept underlying every word is basic. It's made out of one piece. It can't be disassembled into simpler parts. So that the meaning of the word carburetor is the thought carburetor, and the thought carburetor doesn't have simpler parts like an artifact or a purpose or a function or material and so on. And I think that the linguistic arguments that Jerry makes that there aren't any internal parts to thoughts like to paint or carburetor or to itch are just wrong.
Well, we'll go back to another book that you wrote, The Blank Slate. At the other extreme, lots of people believe that our minds start out without any innate contents, and through experience or cultural construction or something, that's how we get them. And that's why many things can go, because cultural construction and experience can deliver all sorts of new... What do you think about that thought?
Yeah, well, in The Blank Slate, this is philosophy talk, so I can quote a couple of philosophers out of context. Lockett... quote, paraphrasing Aristotle, has said there's nothing in the mind that was not first in the senses, and to which Leibniz replied, except for the mind itself, or except for the intellect itself. So yeah, our particular concepts of other people, of desks and chairs and tables and hockey teams and so on, we acquire every single one of them. On the other hand, we couldn't acquire them unless we had more elementary kinds of thoughts, a kind of scaffolding around which we build particular thoughts, or concepts like causality, space, time, object, agency, intention. The mind is furnished with those elementary concepts, at least so I argue, and that's what makes our sophisticated learning possible.
We've got a lineup of callers on the line. Kate from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kate.
Oh, hello. I'm very glad. Thank you for taking the call. I was in Africa, and we were looking at stone tools and things like that, and I was told that the big thing, one of these things that makes us human kind of big thing, was the ability to plan. The fact that these stones had been gotten from a number of miles away and had brought back to this place meant that these hominids or humans were able to plan. And I was wondering, then of course we would have to be able to communicate our plans. So how would that work in with thought and language? And does that make sense?
Let's see if Stephen thinks so. Thanks for the question, Kate. What do you think, Stephen?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's what we do with thoughts. We make plans. We build mental models of the world. We simulate what would happen in the world if we did this thing versus some other thing. If we like what a simulated action would do, we then take the next mental step and we imagine what could then be done in the world that was just changed by that action. And we build long chains of possible actions in the mind's eye, and that's one of the things that makes us so smart. So
this goes back to John's thought that this action, the payoff for action, is the big deal here, right? We're not just observers of the world. We're actors in the world, and our action has to be designed to get the things we want or desire or value to be realized. So this all stuff will only work if it has a payoff for action.
Well, I mean, let me go back to one of my favorite passages in philosophy, which is Wittgenstein's little story about the builders. So you've got a builder and his assistant, and they're building walls, and they use four different kinds of stones. I don't know, pillars, slabs, blocks, and something. And their language just consists of those four words, pillar, slab, block, so forth. But each utterance isn't just naming something. It's telling the assistant to go get that thing. Everything about what's wanted is in place except the kind involved. So that seems to me to kind of suggest the first step on the do this, do that, get this. Simple function of language to get people to do something that they already understand what they're supposed to do, to description, where you add a little bit to the structure that's already there. And from that has evolved all of science, quarks, and everything else. That's my humble view.
What do you think about that humble view of John, who's not a very humble man, actually?
I think that sounds perfectly reasonable. And if you look at the way that people in a more ecologically natural lifestyle work, they do engage in long, complex chains of reasoning about the future. My favorite example comes from Napoleon Chagnon in his study of the Yanomamo, where they were hunting an armadillo, which then scurried into a burrow, and they had no idea where to find it. It was underground. And one of them hit on the idea of lighting a fire from a substance that you smoldered and produced thick smoke. They fanned it down the opening of the armadillo burrow, knowing that they would suffocate the animal. Then another one took a long vine, broke it off, fed it through the burrow, while another one had its ears to the ground, listening for the thumping. And when the vine could go no further into the burrow, they pulled it out, laid it on the ground, measured the length, dug up the spot at the end of the vine, and they struck armadillo.
Yeah. Wow!
Right. So look, here's my sort of closing thought on this thought about thought. I mean, so language is such a cool thing because it enables us to do everything that the individual mind can do on its own together and do it much better. Individual agents can plan, but through language, we can plan together. We can have joint plans. Individual agents can investigate the world and have reasons for their beliefs, but through language, we can share the reasons for our beliefs. So language sort of binds all the capacities for human thought together. I mean, even science is this complex, cooperative, cognitive endeavor made possible through language. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why we have language. It allows us to be part of almost a larger mind consisting of all of the hard-won discoveries and products of trial and error and strokes of genius from every other member of our species. Language allows us to pool that knowledge.
And to dominate the planet, because it's like a Mack truck cognitive instrument. And I think that's why we dominate the planet, because we can share all this stuff with each other and coordinate over these large stretches of space and time. What do you think of that?
That's the basis for the old story of the Tower of Babel, that if everyone spoke one language, we'd be so powerful we could reach heaven itself. But it's a... I think it's an acknowledgement of the extraordinary power that language gives humans by means of coordinating action and pooling knowledge.
So then, since you brought up heaven, what are the theological implications of your view?
Very quickly.
It sounds like God could get by with thought. He wouldn't really need language because he didn't have anyone to talk to.
Except us. There is something theologically mysterious about language. I mean, in the beginning was the Word in the New Testament. There's something about words and the way that they can somehow extend tentacles into reality that the human mind finds deeply mysterious. And many cultures have reinvented forms of word magic, prayer and incantations and taboos, as if somehow words are directly connected to reality, and by uttering a word you could change reality.
Stephen, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Stephen Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, author of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago. I think, therefore I blog.
You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.